lifestyle choices, and environmental factors impact your brain health and the physiology and psychology of your mental health. When you're ready to turn your brain on to get your game on, listen to In Your Head Radio. Now here's your host, Lee Richardson.
Thanks for being with me today and listening in. I've got an interesting show. I've got Joe Serio, and Joe's a PhD, and his mission is to help people give themselves permission to embrace and engage their leadership potential through unique, highly interactive, and engaging sessions. He attended SUNY in Albany, studied political science, Russian, and Spanish. That's an interesting combination for the brain. He is the ninth of 12 siblings, and he was the only American to work in the Organized Crime Control Department of the Soviet police, and later was the director of the Moscow office of the world's leading corporate investigation and business intelligence firm. He lived in China for a year. He worked for the CIA. He drove a cab in New York, which is another brain trip, and has authored, co-authored, edited, and translated 20 books. When he was growing up, he was pretty much afraid of everything. And look how he found his courage. Joe, thanks so much for being with me.
Hi, Lee. Thanks for having me.
So you do have an interesting background. And I love the fact that you said, you know, growing up, you were pretty much afraid of everything. Is that because you had so many siblings? Oh, my gosh. Or where did that come from?
Yeah, part of it was that being the ninth of that particular group. When I look back up the line as I was growing up, my oldest one's a priest. The second one is an Ivy League educated dentist. The third one could play 20 instruments by the time she was 20 years old. And it just kept going like that. It goes like that all down the line. And as growing up, I was looking up at that line, convincing myself that somehow I needed to do all of those things and I had to be as good as all of them. But at the same time, we grew up in a traditional home of the era. I grew up in the 60s and 70s. My dad was an immigrant from Sicily, and he grew up during the Great Depression. So he was one of those guys who did not express himself particularly in a positive emotional sense. He was also that person who said, oh, you got a 97 on the test. What happened to the other 3 points?
Ooh.
So, yeah, 97 was a failing grade in my house growing up. So I also, if you combine that with being a sensitive child, I took all of it and compounded it into this formula for how to bury yourself and basically figure out how to play the game on the surface, but really get paralyzed and not be able to pursue the things that were really dancing in my head. And the thing that I wanted to do at 13, 14 years old is actually what I do now, is write books, travel, speak, consult, deliver keynote addresses, and help people understand their own fear, which, you know, if you talk philosophically, looking back at your life, maybe all those things had to happen. Maybe I had to have all those stories and that trauma in order to understand other people's later in life so I could help them get out of their own way.
Well, I think that's a great way to look at it. And I think that, you know, it's a journey for all of us. I mean, I left the world of human performance and went into the world of brain performance after one of my sons got hit by a car. And after that, about 3 years after that, it became a big issue and I started looking for solutions. So I do think that there's some subconscious intent for all of us on our journey. And I was a twin and I had one other sibling and I had twins, but I can't imagine being one of, I can't even close my eyes and visualize being one of 12. And so you're being so open about how that, you know, your childhood did influence you. And I think it's amazing that you wanted at 13 years old what you have today.
Well, it's a key element for me in my programs, in my classes, in my trainings. I run several leadership academies. My audience is focused on government agencies, and specifically public safety, and I do a lot of 911 dispatcher training on leadership. And the thing we talk about a lot is our narratives. What's that story that we told ourselves in order to be loved and lovable, in order to feel accepted and acceptable, who it is we thought we had to be for other people's purposes? And for my audience, I don't want them to feel like that anymore. I don't want them to have to be stuck in that old story. And I want them to be able to create a new story for themselves, to give themselves permission to have their life. And telling the story, of course, there's the ooh-ah factor, right? I tell a story about growing up in a family of 12 kids, and it's so atypical that people are shocked. So there's a little shock value in it. But I also talk about my family because I want my audience to think about their families. I want them to think about how they grew up. I want them to think about the things that they're hanging on to, the obstacles that they probably created without knowing it at 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, when we create the narrative of our lives and end up believing it for so long until and unless we reconfigure it. And my job is to help people reconfigure their stories so that they can see a different future and a different possibility for their own lives, and they don't have to be locked in the narrative, the demands of other people, their own trauma, that they don't have, that they are allowed to identify their own needs, you know. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think that's so important, because the way that the brain processes information is it turns it into a story. The kicker is that the information that it uses doesn't have to be accurate. It'll just whatever's floating out there in the brain. Oh, there's a blank. I need to fill that in. It'll grab it and stick it in. And that story will spin and spin and spin. And oftentimes, working with people at the Brain Performance Center and the Brain Performance Institute, you know, I'll say, is that really what happened? Mm-hmm. And it's at that point, I can see, you know, the head tilt or the look in the eye, and it's like, I don't know. So I think what you're doing is so important, because all those stories are held on a subconscious level. We're not going to challenge them on the conscious level until we get the support we need to do so.
Right. And it's so rewarding. For me personally, it's rewarding because I get a front row seat to watch people in my programs do things, right? I don't particularly care for a one-day class, which is why I developed six-month academies. And so in the six-month academy for 911 dispatchers, we meet one day a month in person, wherever in the country. So I travel to them. And then they have to read my books in between the modules. So we have a module on fear, and then they read my fear book. And the assignment is for them to pay attention to their fear and when it gets triggered over the course of the month. When we come back in for the next module, we talk about what their experience was interacting with the book, but also interacting with themselves over the previous month. Well, you know, we go through that fear, emotional intelligence, stress management, resilience, those kinds of modules. And I've seen people do unbelievable things. I mean, it's not a point of pride of how many marriages I've broken up, but I've given people a lot of strength to realize that they're in a marriage they should have been out of a long time ago. And the program gives them a chance to do that. And people have lost 20, 30, 40, 50 pounds. They've gotten off of medications. They've changed their communication style with their spouses and their kids. And it's absolutely stunning to me, being the way that I grew up. It's stunning to me that, number one, they do it. They run with the information and process it and feel it. And then they go do something about it, which is the best. I mean, it's the only reason. You know, we have to pay bills and all that, but for me, this is the only reason and the best reason to do this, to have this calling, so that I get to see other people get to see the promise of their own lives.
Well, I think you get to be a part of it. I mean, you're helping them transform, and there's nothing that feels better. I can identify with that statement. Nothing feels better than to help feel like that I actually helped someone take a step forward that maybe maybe they wouldn't have taken without the right support and the education. And it's interesting to me because I think fear is such a driving force in all of us. And I would think a 911 dispatcher would have a fair amount of that on a daily basis.
Yeah, they have unlimited levels of stress, and they have fear. And in public safety, maybe even more so. I mean, generally, people don't like to talk about fear or admit that they're afraid, but more so in public safety. And so as human beings, oftentimes we'll skirt around the real issue, and we'll self-sabotage, and we'll procrastinate, and we'll act out and lash out. And wait a second, if you slow down long enough to understand what's really going on, we can trace almost everything back to fear. I'm afraid that I won't send the police to the right address. I'm afraid that there might be a call where someone will die. I'm afraid that I won't be able to handle this stress, and on and on and on. But at its core, what we talk about in class and what I totally believe is, at its core, whatever we're all afraid of, it comes down to a couple of things. One is not being enough, and not being loved, and being left alone. And I think we construct all kinds of behaviors around that in kind of an attempt to stave off the possibility that we'll be rejected. Of course, it's all a game. It's all a brain game, right? Because we usually end up hurting ourselves more by dancing around things than facing them. But the fact of the matter is, most people haven't learned it. And my audiences definitely have not learned it and been exposed to it growing up, or they're not big readers, or they don't have time to reflect because they got into their jobs right after high school or right after college. And a lot of the things that we talk about, the kinds of things that you talk about in the Brain Institute, is they have never thought about in their lives. I had one woman almost jump out of her seat in the second module of my 6-month academy. And she just kind of yelled out, "My mother." And I was like, "Wait, what? So what just happened?" And she was putting together pieces in her mind about how she grew up, about how she interacts with her mom, about how that influences how she interacts with her own children, and that she had put her own needs on hold to satisfy or to not disappoint the people who were arguably the most important people in our lives, the most influential people in our lives. And we convince ourselves that we can't draw boundaries, or we don't know how to draw boundaries, and we're not allowed, we're not entitled to, we don't deserve our own needs. And I'll tell you, from a personal level, I think I was about 48 when I fully realized that I was allowed to have my own needs. And it was a shock. And then I understood what I had been doing the previous 40 years and how I had been kind of racing around trying to get what I thought I needed, which wasn't what I needed the most, but it's what felt the best. You know what I mean? And we go through these behaviors of trying to get attention or trying to get whatever that hole is. And we do it in ways that often are not very healthy. So if I could take my story and share it with them and get them to have insights about their own lives, that's really what it's about for me.
Well, and I think that introduces a level of comfort, and that makes people want to share their story. And it's so interesting that people will have hidden something for 20 years, or will push it down for 20 years until the right opportunity, until someone makes them feel special enough, or whatever word you want to use, you know, that gives them the freedom to act. And, you know, I think we all have energy. I call it energy. Some people call it power, but we all have energy within ourselves that gives us the freedom to act. When you look at the work you do, do you tap into their inner powers, to their energies? What do you tap into?
So the first thing that I have to be very careful about is how I engage at the very beginning. For example, I run retreats at a ranch outside San Antonio. And one thing that we spend a fair amount of time on, the first couple of hours, is breaking the ice so that everybody can get a level of comfort with each other. And these are all strangers from different various agencies. So the first thing we do is to help them relax. I'm a huge believer in you're not going to learn as well as you can, and you're not going to feel as deeply as possible unless you're relaxed. So we spend a lot of time on that. Secondly, I try not to go too directly. Like, I don't go directly in speaking about energy. I don't go directly in speaking about God, religion, spirit, any of those things, but it's really what we're doing. And what I like to be able to do is just to make sure that they feel two things. One, or create the opportunity for them to feel, number one, that they're in a safe space, and number two, that what I'm doing and how I'm coming across is real, which is one reason why I talk about my family. Because one thing that helps them to tap into their energy is to know that me and some of my other instructors at the ranch programs have been where they are, and we'll just talk about our lives without dressing it up, without being slick speakers or posing or posturing. We just talk about how it is. And it helps to give them permission. It helps to help them relax. One thing that happened in terms of energy and unlocking oneself, I'll tell you, last month we had a ranch program, which I run about five times a year. And it was for about 40 dispatchers. And we had a woman there who was 61 years old. And she said, I have never cried. And she's been divorced a few times. And she told me that, actually, she told the entire group, which I give her huge credit for. She said, my mother beat it into us so thoroughly that we are not allowed to express emotion. We are not allowed to cry. And one thing she did during that week was cry. She cried a lot because the floodgates had been opened. And she felt like she was in a safe place where the group had hit it off. The group did their icebreakers. The group really touched with each other in a way that they hadn't felt before, especially as dispatchers that don't get support from law enforcement a lot of the times. The public never sees them. They don't know who they are, and they don't get closure on calls. So imagine that you had a call where someone got injured or hurt or died or whatever, and you will never hear about the end of that call. So now you're left to create. As you said, the brain is going to fill in. When the brain doesn't have all the information, it will make it up, it will fill in the holes, and then you have to carry that around. So we help the dispatchers and law enforcement to, number one, relax enough. Number two, tap into their own story and think about their parents and think about their childhood. And also to think, as you said earlier, maybe I misinterpreted some things. Maybe the things I came to believe were never actually spoken or done to me, or were about me. And in some cases, of course, they were, and they have to deal with that as well. So we hit in the energy of self-awareness and self-forgiveness and self-compassion, almost never using those words, but to be able to create the feeling for the audience.
Well, I think that, you know, the fact that you don't have to use those words is pretty powerful. It truly is. And that tapping into that emotional intelligence, it really does open doors. So how big is the group that you're working with on these retreats?
Yeah, the retreat groups are around 40 people. And I have about five or six instructors and facilitators with me.
Okay. So you've each person is maybe got six or seven people in their group?
A little bit smaller. So we set up the room in such a way that there are four people in a group, and they get a chance to talk with each other. They get a chance to talk with instructors. They get a chance to talk with the large group. The other thing about the ranch that's as important as the work is the play. And that's something that, you know, people like dispatchers or law enforcement, they tend to not play a lot. They don't get off their own backs. So they're away from home, they're off their phones, and we bring them horseback riding. We do horseback riding, we have three nights of live music, cookouts, barbecues, and just to get them to relax, it's part of the energy process. Can we get you to relax from the moment you arrive? get to know each other as quickly as possible so that you can access yourself, so that you can access what you're feeling, how you made decisions, how you ended up in the place that you're in right now.
So most of them there for personal growth, or most of them there to satisfy a requirement of the job?
So most of them are there to satisfy a requirement of the job. Most of them are told to go, or some of them have gone to their supervisors and asked to go to the program. The program is very well known and very popular in 911 spots, and it sells out about a year in advance. So people know about it, and they request of their supervisors if they could go. But what they don't understand, a lot of people, frankly, leave, they roll their eyes, and they say, oh, I'm going to another leadership program. Well, at least it's at a ranch, and I'll have fun. But leadership is leadership. And what they end up saying by the end of day one is, I feel like I was just in therapy. And of course, it's not therapy, but they don't expect that at all. It's a totally different program. It's different than any class they've ever been to in their life. And it takes an approach that's different than anything they experienced. So by the end of day one, it's very emotional. They're pretty drained. They tap into things that they hadn't in a long time. They have emotional reactions. I had a gentleman in last month who he said, I haven't thought about these. He was about 24, 25 years old. He said, I haven't thought about any of these things. I'm looking at my whole life differently, and not only in the past, but what I can do going forward because of that kind of curated environment, if you want to put it like that. We're really careful to have that spirit of the program.
Well, that gentleman, to be able to have that opportunity at 24 or 25, that's a blessing. That is truly a blessing. And because what I have seen in my practices is oftentimes people don't get that opportunity that early. And the longer things live in the subconscious, the bigger they become. And I mean, true fact, every minute our brain is capable of taking in an unbelievable amount of data, billions of bits of data. And research says that somewhere between 40 and 126 bits of data can go into your conscious cognitive level. I think it's 40, but I don't think we have to do the math. It all goes to the subconscious. And so to be able to touch that, I mean, on the first day, that's amazing.
The sad part of all of it is, In the groups of the people I work with, generally speaking, in dispatch and law enforcement, criminal justice and government, a lot of people never have been to a conference or a training in their life. Above and beyond the technical, you know, how do we run a phone call and how do we run 911? Other than that, I've had so many people that have never been to a training before, or they've been in the field for 20, 25 years, and they say, what could my life have been if I had had this training at the beginning? And that's what I love when we get people of all ages, but especially the young ones, say, oh, now I have a different roadmap, or I have a different kind of blueprint that I can draw from as I grow older.
Well, do you find that there's any, I don't know what the right word is, maybe bitterness because they didn't get that opportunity earlier?
Oh, they have all kinds of reasons. A little bit upset, maybe a little bit angry after the fact, once they realize what could have been, but they're filled with so much emotion in the first place, because of the job, because of their lives, because what happened is that, you know, the jobs are extremely difficult, so they're stressed. Some of them are burnt out. They're in marriages that they didn't want to be in. They have. You know, an existence that wasn't what they planned, like so many people, you know, that happens with. They've got bureaucracies, they've got politics, they've got uncooperative supervisors, they've got negativity inside and out themselves and their environments. So they come to the programs with all kinds of things that are just all kinds of emotions that are just dragging them down. And on top of that, they have a hard time saying no. They don't know how to say no to people. Because they're helpers at their essence. So they keep giving away their time and giving away their energy, and then exacerbating their own frustration that they don't have what they want in life.
Wow. So are they people pleasers?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They're caretakers, caregivers, people pleasers, at the same time while being type A personalities, which is an interesting combination.
I bet it is. What's interesting, because, you know, I think everybody's a leader. I think everybody's a leader. It doesn't matter what role you're in. Everybody is a leader. And the hard thing is to get people to really understand and recognize I am a leader and mm-hmm. I can move into that leadership role, or I can choose not to. And it's a choice. And I've had that conversation and been told, oh, no, I've never been offered the choice. So I think the way that you do it, you're making it pretty obviously, you're inviting them. You're making them comfortable. You're making them happy. You're opening the door for them.
I had somebody come to that ranch program. And from the moment she walked in, she said, yeah, I'm negative Nancy. I was like, oh, okay, this is interesting. This might be a long week. And her colleague was with her, and she pointed to her and said, yeah, she is. And no tension. It was just matter of fact. And negative Nancy said, I'm retiring in 6 months, which of course makes me wonder why they sent her to the ranch in the first place. She said, I'm retiring in 6 months. And by day three, she called back to her supervisor and said, I changed my mind. I'm not retiring for another 5 years. And here's why. Because sitting here in this program, I realized that I'm the problem. And I could have been making so many contributions to our 911 center, and I haven't. And I want to have a chance before I retire to make some positive contributions. It's like, wow, that's incredible.
That you is, well, she had good self-awareness. I mean, she recognized she was negative Nancy to start with.
Yeah. Yeah. And that helps. And so we go through things like self-awareness, you know, fear, emotional intelligence, communication, how to size up people. One thing I did when I was in the CIA was read people. Actually, I learned it at home because of all the people under one roof at home and traveling around the world, is how to size up people, how to read people, and then teach my audiences how to do that so that they can adjust their style of communication depending on who they're interacting with. And instead of being demanding, negative all the time, let's take a step back and understand, where's the person I'm trying to persuade? Where's the person I'm trying to help coming from? And let me adjust myself a little bit so that they are able to receive me, that they're able to hear what I'm saying. And in turn, I can hear what their concerns and their fears are.
Well, and that's such an interesting population that you work with, because I think everybody has stress in their daily life every day, but that job, those jobs just ooze stress at you. And the intensity of that stress, I mean, you mentioned someone, did I send the police to the wrong spot? You know, is somebody going to die? Those are pretty heavy duty requirements to deal with on a daily basis. Do you give people, I mean, everybody comes to the ranch, they find calmness, they find some inner peace. What happens when they go back to the hot box? What do you give them? What do they take with them that keeps them in that inner peace?
Yeah, in addition to the experience itself, we give them a lot of tools. We give them a lot of simple tools, and we give them warnings. You know, the one warning is, don't try to use all these tools because you'll get overwhelmed and you'll quit. But just pick one or two things that speaks to the issue that you're trying to get better at interacting with, and work that tool, you know, use that for a while and see how that goes. And the second thing is, don't go home all bubbly that, oh my God, I had a wonderful experience, and oh, I'm so transformed and whatever. Nobody at home will understand you. And not only will they not understand you, they'll resent you and they'll push back and they'll undermine whatever you're trying to do. So we give them some very practical advice about how to handle the post-ranch kind of reintegration into their agency. But also we give them tools. We give them a bound workbook so that they have that. We also have one of the people in the group form a Facebook group. So every ranch class has its own Facebook group, its own private Facebook group, where they can talk to each other and commiserate, share policies, ask whatever questions they want to ask each other. So it's like that. So there are a number of things that we can do to help them with that integration. But for your point, a little bit about that bigger point of how do you hang on to that feeling, that's why I created the 6-month academy, so that you had 6 months of practicing and 6 months of convincing yourself that you can do things differently, you can get different outcome, and you can get used to responding differently to your environment instead of reacting to it. And next year we'll launch a year-long program that will start at the ranch for the first week, and then we'll be online for the rest of the year. And that's specifically to create new leaders. It's called the High Performance Academy, growing tomorrow's 911 leaders today, so that they've been through a lot of practicing of tools for themselves, for wellness, for stress management, meditation, for practicing tools of how to interact with people, how to interact with difficult people, to give them tools on how to manage difficult conversations, how to manage their own energy, what's happening inside their brain. We talk about the limbic system. We talk about prefrontal cortex. We talk about how neurologically it's very difficult to think straight when your IQ is plummeting, when you move from fear, when you move from calm to alert to alarm to fear, and your IQ points are dropping and you can't think straight and you get into a rage or frustrated or shut down or walk away, whether it's freeze, fight, flight, whether it's, you know, your communication style as an amiable or as a driver, as an expressive or as an analytical. We go through all the details of those things and help them to think about it differently and then give them tools to correspondingly bring those that knowledge into practice.
Well, I think those tools, you know, and it, whether or not knowing that you have them, knowing that they're there, whether or not you reach out and tap into them, I have found that knowing that I have resources gives me confidence. It truly does.
Yeah, and the tools that we give them are very simple. Like, we don't overthink it. We talk about diaphragmatic breathing and the fact that you can turn off the stress response and turn on the relaxation response within 3 deep breaths. And then you can reframe your cognitive, the cognitive, physiological, and behavioral interconnections of emotional intelligence, and that this game is won or lost on self-regulation. It's not on the other person changing their behavior. You can't change the other person, so you better deal with yourself and be clever enough to figure out what is that other person doing? What's the fear that they're feeling? And maybe I don't need to push back on them. And maybe I don't even have to open my mouth, especially if someone's in my face, whether it's a caller or a colleague or whatever. It doesn't mean I have to react with the same energy that they're coming to me with. Because if I do, I'm almost assuredly going to lose. That this whole situation will go down the tubes. If I meet their negative energy, their fearful energy with the same energy at high volume, argumentative and all the rest of it, conflict, it's not going to work. And we talk a lot about that.
You know, that's such an interesting comment, because I mentioned earlier I had twins and I had 2 boys. And, you know, things would get crazy and they would start screaming and hollering. And of course, my first reaction was, well, what do you think I did? I screamed back.
Right.
And I had done some reading, and I don't even remember now where I read it, because those boys are 36. But it said when they start screaming, whisper. When you talk back to them, whisper. And so I'm like, oh, yeah. Like, that's going to work. Well, you know, you get to the point some days where you don't have any other, what else am I going to do?
Right.
And I did it, and it worked. It just, You know, and I honestly, I have no idea where I read that, but that was the best, probably the best advice I got for dealing with 2-3-year-old boys. And they were just normal boys. They weren't.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. That's what we talk about in class is like, okay, what was your kid doing? What is your child guilty of? Your child is guilty of being a 3-year-old. That's about it.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, and I tell people this all the time, I said, you know, at the end of the day, with my husband always traveled, some days I had better days than others, but at the end of the day, I would ask myself one question, and that question was, did you make the best decision you could at the moment? Not how good it was it the best decision at the moment? And if I could answer yes, I was a happy camper. I called it a good day. So I understand that the approach that you're taking, and we don't have a lot of time left, but one thing that didn't come up that I see so many people challenge with, and that's self-sabotage. I'd love to get your comments on that.
So that's one thing we talk about in a number of my classes. And the one statement I make to my audiences is that their biggest problem is them. And I truly believe that. I think my biggest problem in my life is me. And their biggest problem is them. And within the context of our lives, the biggest problem we have is self-sabotage. And it could be small. I mean, it could be daily. It could be, think about how you start the day. I know for myself, and because of my history, if I start the day with my phone in bed, I'm going to lose. I'll probably lose the entire day. It doesn't mean I won't do work. It means that I won't be nearly as productive as I could be. Because if I'm not traveling, I can stay in bed for an hour, 2 hours. I'm like everybody else. I'll scroll. I'll get sucked into whatever vortex of social media grabs my attention. So I know that I have to protect my mornings a lot. And that means my phone doesn't come to bed with me. And it also means that I have to wake up and read. In the mornings, I read a lot of Stoic philosophy. I read a lot of psychology or inspirational, motivational, whatever you want to call it, self-help. I read all of that because it sets the tone for the day. I watch motivational videos, not even watch them. I just have them playing in the background to get my day started, because I know that I will get set up for a lot of self-sabotage. I will set myself up for a lot of self-sabotage. The other thing is, from a productivity and work perspective, I only work an hour at a time. I consciously have to say to myself, okay, it's 1 o'clock. What am I doing from 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock? And focus. Because I know the three, if you think about self-sabotage and the three superpowers that people could have, which I talked about in my podcast, is number one, clarity. Where are you going? What are you trying to accomplish? Number two is focus. And number three is consistency. And if people can figure just those three things out, their lives will change. Guarantee. There's no doubt in my mind about that. Under clarity is things like, who am I? What do I want? How am I going to get it? How am I lying to myself? And then focusing is, okay, do I have the tools? Do I have the space? Do I need quiet time? How can I create that quiet time? Whose cooperation do I need, et cetera, et cetera? And then consistency is, obviously, how do I do this on a regular basis? It's the same way I studied Chinese and Russian and Spanish. It's the same
way I learned how to... That makes total sense. And what a great message to share with our listeners to end on. I think that because self-sabotage is something that we've all done. And for our listeners out there, if you think about the three superpowers, the clarity, the focus, and what was the third, Joe?
Consistency,
the three C's. So for our listeners that are out there, I know you're on social media. Where is the best place for them to learn more about you?
The best place is my website, joeserio.com, joeserio.com.
Okay. Well, I thoroughly enjoyed our talk, and I learned a lot that, I hadn't thought about what I told you about whispering. I haven't thought about that in 25 years. So thank you so much for bringing that back in my memory. Thank you for being on the show. I thoroughly enjoyed our time together.
Thank you so much for having me.
On behalf of Lee Richardson and the Brain Performance Center, we want to thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear more episodes like this, visit us on iTunes, Google Play, TogiNet, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and thebrainperformancecenter.com.